Chapter 39. The Oregon docked at Southend-on-Sea at the mouth of the Thames just past 6 a.m. The operatives were all awake and showered. One by one, they filed into the dining room for breakfast. They were due to meet in the conference room at 7. Hanley had grabbed a few hours' rest and then had been back at work by 5 a.m., planning the logistics for the coming operation. Just after 6, he telephoned Overholt and woke him. "Our team is going into London soon," he said. "We think we have the principals located, but so far we have yet to detect traces of radiation."
"Are you coordinating with MI5?
Overholt asked. "Mr. Cabrillo will contact them soon and turn over command of the operation. He just wants to make sure our team is in place as a backup."
"Sounds reasonable," Overholt said wearily. "What's the status on the meteorite?"
"We're doing things one at a time," Hanley said. "As soon as the threat of the bomb is gone, we'll switch our team over to that problem."
"What's the current location?"
"Just south of Oxford," Hanley said. "Headed south. If it comes within the outskirts of London, we'll move on it. If not, we'll deal with it when the bomb is recovered."
"The Las Vegas police have been stymied, so I issued a national security directive that gives them authority to do whatever we need."
"They should be entering the penthouse soon. You know that if you're wrong and Hickman is not behind this, by the time the fallout settles, I'll be out of a job."
"Not to worry, Mr. Overholt," Hanley said. "We are always looking for qualified applicants to join our team."
"You're a regular barrel of laughs, Mr. Hanley,"
Overholt said as he disconnected. Hanley replaced the telephone in the cradle on his command chair and turned to Stone. "How are the arrangements coming?"
"As usual, Mr. Truett has been Johnny on the spot," Stone said. "He's been working since early this morning. He's purchased sets of British clothing and overcoats for the people we're sending to London. He's also arranged for a tour bus to pick them up here. Last I spoke with him, he was on the bus on his way here."
"Good man," Hanley said. "What about Nixon?"
"Nixon has the equipment ready and is completing the final checks as we speak."
"Halpert?" Hanley asked. "Still hard at work, last I checked. He claims he's pursuing a different angle and should have the details in another few hours."
"Go over the roster," Hanley said.
"We have 4 in London already," Stone said, reading from a printed sheet. "Cabrillo, Seng, Meadows, and Truett. The 6 to be transported are Huxley, Jones, Lincoln, Cassim, Murphy, and Ross."
"That gives us a force of 10 inside London," Hanley noted.
"Correct," Stone said. "Air support at Heathrow is Adams in the Robinson and Gunderson and Pilston in the Gulfstream. Judy Michaels just flew in from her leave and is taking over the amphibian piloting."
"Operations on the Oregon?" Hanley asked.
"The vessel will be crewed by Gannon, Barrett, Hornsby, Reinhold, and Rise."
"Who does that leave?"
"You, me, Nixon in the magic shop, Crabtree here on logistics, and King," Stone finished.
"I forgot about King," Hanley said. "We need him in there as support."
"Do you want me to include him in Truett's group?"
Hanley thought for a moment.
"No," he finally said. "Have Adams pick him up and put them both on standby. I want them close to the scene and ready to take to the air at a moment's notice. Adams and King can provide air cover."
"I'll make the arrangements," Stone said.
"Excellent."
"Truett cased the principal's apartment building early this morning," Cabrillo said. Cabrillo, Sang, and Meadows were eating breakfast in the chairman's suite.
"Where is he now?" Meadows asked. "He's on his way to the port where the Oregon is docked to pick up the rest of the team."
"Then I guess he didn't detect traces of the bomb," Sang said, "or we'd have already moved by now."
"Correct," Cabrillo said.
"So we have to wait until they move?" Meadows asked.
"If the bomb is in London," Cabrillo said, "and the principals realize someone's on to them, they could blow it at any time.
They might not be at their primary target yet, but with a nuclear warhead, even a small one like this, the destruction would be horrific. So we try to flush them out, Tseng asked, then make the grab and defuse the weapon?
I'm sure that's not what MI5 wants, Cabrillo said, but that's what I'll recommend.
When do you meet with them? Meadows asked. Cabrillo wiped his mouth with the linen napkin and stared at his wristwatch.
In 5 minutes, he said, in the lobby.
What would you like us to do? Tseng asked.
Walk the area near the apartment and get the lay of the land.
Edward Gibb was not happy. Being awakened on New Year's Eve and ordered into work was not his idea of a pleasant holiday. An attorney had telephoned this morning and asked if he could meet the new owner of the mill and unlock the doors. Gibb had almost refused. He'd decided on retirement and was planning to tell the Human Resources Department as soon as they all returned to work, but the idea of meeting the mysterious buyer of Maidenhead Mills intrigued him. After showering, dressing, and eating a quick breakfast of tea and toast, he drove over to the mill. A limousine was idling near the front doors, the exhaust creating puffs of smoke in the chill air. Gibb approached and knocked on the rear window. The window slid down, and a man smiled.
"Mr. Gibb?"
he asked.
Gibb nodded.
"Halifax Hickman,"
the man said, climbing out of the rear and standing on the asphalt near the doors.
"Allow me to apologize for taking you away from your family on a holiday."
The men shook hands.
"No problem, sir," Gibb said, walking toward the door. "I can understand you might want to see what you spent your money on as soon as possible."
"I was on my way to Europe," Hickman lied, "and am limited in time."
"I understand, sir,"
Gibb said as he reached into his pocket and removed a set of keys and unlocked the door.
"Thank you,"
Hickman said as Gibb opened the door and stood aside.
"Keep these," Gibb said, handing Hickman the keys. "I have another set."
Hickman slid them into his pocket. Gibb walked past the reception area and through the doors into the massive shop floor where the mills and fabric were stored. Reaching over to a breaker switch on the wall, he flipped it on. The interior of the massive room lit up. Gibb looked over at Hickman. The man was scanning the various machines.
"This is the final stage shaver and vacuum unit," he said, pointing to a machine that looked like a large version of a broiler unit used at Burger King. "The material is fed in on the belt, it's treated, and then it comes out here on these series of rollers."
The metal frame that contained the rollers was waist-high and went to an area for packing. Then it stretched in a half-circle to end near the loading dock. Bolts of cloths could be pushed along until they were boxed or wrapped, and then taken along to the trucks for shipment. Hickman's eyes were scanning the area nearby.
"Are those the prayer rugs for Saudi Arabia?"
he asked, staring at three large metal shipping containers near the milling machine and next to the door to the docks.
"Can I see them?"
"Yes, sir,"
Gibb said, unlocking each of the containers and swinging the doors open. "And they are overdue to be delivered." Hickman peeked inside. Each of the metal containers was as large as a semi-trailer. They were designed to be loaded aboard a 747 cargo plane. The rugs were hanging from vices on the ceiling of the containers and stretched forward as far as the eye could see. Each container held thousands.
"Why aren't they stacked?" Hickman asked.
"We have to spray them with insecticide and disinfectant before they're allowed into Saudi Arabia. They don't want mad cow disease or some other airborne pathogen brought in. Every country makes that mandatory now," Gibb said.
"Leave them open," Hickman said, "and give me the keys to the containers."
Gibb nodded and handed Hickman the keys.
"When are the workers due back from holiday?"
Hickman asked.
"Monday, January 2nd,
Gibb said, following Hickman, who was walking back through the machines toward the lobby area again.
"I've got some guys from the U.S. coming in to help. We'll make those a top priority," Hickman said as they neared the lobby and front offices. "Now, can you show me to an office where I might use a telephone?"
Gibb pointed to stairs that led to a glass-enclosed office overlooking the shop floor.
You're welcome to use mine, sir. It's unlocked.
Hickman smiled and reached out for Gibb's hand.
Mr. Gibb, he said easily, why don't you get back to your family? I'll see you on Monday.
Gibb nodded and started for the door, then stopped.
Mr. Hickman, he said slowly, would you like to come over this evening and celebrate the new year with us?
Hickman was halfway to the stairs and turned back to look at Gibb.
That's a kind offer, he said. But for me, New Year is always a time for quiet reflection.
No family, sir?
Gibb asked.
I had a son, Hickman said quietly. But he was murdered.
With that, he turned and walked toward the stair. Gibb turned and walked through the door. Hickman was nothing like the newspaper said. He was just a lonely old man, as ordinary as white rice. Gibb might reconsider his plans to retire. With Hickman as owner, big things might be afoot. Hickman entered the office and reached for the telephone. Cabrillo entered the lobby with Meadows and Seng in tow. A blond man, dressed in a black suit and polished shoes, approached immediately.
Mr. Fleming has cordoned off a quiet area of the dining room so you can meet in private, the man said, referring to the head of MI5. It's right this way.
Seng and Meadows headed for the front door. Like magic, several men in the lobby, reading newspapers, rose and followed. They would not be alone for their reconnaissance. Cabrillo followed the blond man into the dining room. Taking a hallway to the left, they entered a private room where a man was seated at a table with a pot of tea and a silver platter of pastries.
Juan,
the man said, rising.
John, Cabrillo said, reaching out to shake hands.
That will be all,
Fleming said to the blond-haired man who walked back through the door and closed it behind him. Fleming motioned to a chair and Cabrillo sat down. Fleming poured Cabrillo a cup of tea and waved his hands over the platter of pastries.
I've eaten, Cabrillo said, taking the cup of tea.
Fleming looked over into Cabrillo's eyes and held them for a minute.
Well, Juan, he said, what the hell is going on?
In the conference room on the Oregon, all the seats were filled. Hanley entered last and walked over to a podium and set a file on top.
Here's the situation right now, Hanley began. We believe we have the location of the bomb pinned down to the general area of the west end of London. Mr. Truitt has checked out the apartment building that the principal, Nabil Lababidi, has secretly rented, and he managed to observe Lababidi and another man coming home late last night. After they entered the apartment, Mr. Truitt swept the area outside the door with a Geiger counter but found no traces of radiation. You six will be going in as support for Mr. Cabrillo, who is already present, along with Mr. Meadows and Mr. Seng. Mr. Truitt also placed a locator on Lababidi's Jaguar, and as of right now, there has been no movement.
What do we think the timetable is? Ross asked.
We still think the plans call for a midnight New Year's Eve attack, Hanley said, as a symbolic gesture.
Will we receive our actual assignments once we're in London?
Murphy asked.
Correct, Hanley said. Mr. Cabrillo will be coordinating with MI5. They and Mr. Cabrillo will assign your actual duties as they unfold.
Hanley's beeper vibrated, and he removed it from his belt and stared at the readout.
Okay, people, he said. Mr. Truitt has arrived to take you into London. He's in front right now. Be sure and take the crates of supplies that Nixon has prepared along with you. They are stacked alongside the gangplank. Any other questions?
No one spoke.
Good luck, then, Hanley said.
The six filed out and down the hallway. Cabrillo finished briefing Fleming, then took a sip of tea.
The Prime Minister will have a problem keeping the public in the dark about this, Fleming admitted.
You know that if the Hamadi group realizes that their cover is blown, they could detonate at any time, Cabrillo told him.
Our best chance is to try to make contact using our voice tape of Al-Khalifa, or simply to wait for them to move and follow them to the bomb, then defuse it.
We should cancel the concert, Fleming said. That reduces the number of people in the area, at least.
I think that will clue in the Hamadi group, Cabrillo said.
We need to at least remove the royal family and the prime minister to safe locations, Fleming said.
If you can do it undetected, Cabrillo said, by all means do.
Prince Charles is scheduled to announce Elton John before his performance, but he could plead sickness, Fleming said.
Use a decoy, Cabrillo offered.
If the plan is to hit the concert, Fleming said, and the weapon is not already in place, then they have to deliver it to the site.
If you have teams covertly check all the areas near the concert with Geiger counters and no radiation is found, then we have to assume they are planning to deliver the warhead to the site by vehicle.
So we eliminate the areas near the concert, and if we find nothing, Fleming said slowly, we just need to control the roads leading into the Mayfair and St. James areas.
Exactly, Cabrillo said. The traffic is already horrible in the area. You just station trucks on the side streets that can be moved into place to seal off the roads. I don't think it'll come to that. If we're correct and Labobiti is in control of the bomb, we know it's not in his Jaguar, but it must be close. I think our only hope is to keep surveillance on him as thick as flies on a carcass, then grab him when the time is right.
If we're wrong and he doesn't lead us to the bomb, Fleming said, then our only hope to stop it is the ring around Mayfair and St. James.
If you place your trucks correctly, there isn't a car in the world that can make it through those streets.
But then, will we have time to defuse the bomb?
Fleming asked. The farther away from the concert we locate it, the more time we'll have. Make sure all your men have diagrams so they know what wires to cut in order to stop the timer from running through its cycle.
Lord, Fleming said, if only we knew exactly where the bomb was.
If we did, Cabrillo said, this would be a hell of a lot easier.